Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And welcome aboard. This is the Disciplined Investor Podcast once again. Good evening, good day. How are you? All the way, let's see, we're on, kind of always look at the counter here. Episode number 93, we're going to make it pretty interesting for you today. We have lots to share. This is Andrew Horowitz, and of course, I'm the host, and thank you so much for your emails last week. It was quite a week of emails, as a matter of fact, and anytime you want to get in touch with me, I do my best to answer every single email, or you can follow me on Twitter. That's Andrew Horowitz on Twitter, or of course, on Facebook. But if you want to email me, just write to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I did want to bring up a couple things for you because we've been working really hard at trying to provide some insight into what's going to be the next phase of this whole, well, this whole economic illness and maybe the recovery, because there's going to be recovery on one side of this, isn't there? Eventually, there's going to be some kind of recovery. So what are we going to do really and how are we going to position ourselves is the big question for this recovery. Well, the first thing we did was we just wrote a story for a combination of a few things. Actually, I was on Twitter the other night, if you didn't catch that, with Leah Laporte and John Dvorak. And the gang over at This Week in Tech, I would dare say, go check it out. It was an interesting hour and a half discussion over there at twit.tv. And I always have a good time when I'm talking with John Dvorak and Leo, of course. We talk about some good technology discussions. But one of the things I did, I prepared a very special paper, research paper, just for that show. And it was all involving, really, what are we going to do in terms of the next phase and how is the recovery really going to... you know, what's going to recover, what sectors. And one of the things that really struck me as interesting with all the nuances of the plan and how it's changing, it seems to me that we have a pretty hip president, at least it seems to me. He just got the approval for his BlackBerry, or at least his BlackBerry-like device, the General Dynamics Selectera, I think it's called, Edge, which is an interesting device, which it has a high level of encryption. It's a couple of thousand, a few thousand dollars for this thing. But at least he's going to have his BlackBerry. He's talking a big game about putting technology and building the infrastructure for technology, the internet, the backbone. This, as I call it, access ubiquitousness. And what does that mean? I don't think it's actually a word. But what it means is that we can have access anywhere, anytime, in any location. And essentially, we can be on our computers at any time we want, and whether we're talking Wi-Fi or whether we're talking the idea of utilizing, you know, the internet via some kind of cellular. I don't really care, but the fact is that we have the ability to get it anywhere that we can. We're close to that. You know, I have my iPhone, and I did the jailbreak, and I have the opportunity to now use a iPhone modem, I think it's called. And you click that, and you put one on your computer, and all of a sudden, voila, I'm on the internet. I have a full 3G connection, and it's pretty fast on my MacBook, I got to tell you. And I've used that several times when I'm at meetings, and nobody's the wiser that I'm sitting there and I'm able to actually communicate and talk and blog or trade or manage the portfolios, which is great because it's something we didn't have a few years ago. But what I think is interesting is that there's going to be a great slant towards technology here and a great spending. So I started to do some work in my office to come up with how are we going to invest in our portfolios for our clients in the area of the next phase of technology and the movement of the technology into the next phase of a recovery. Because again, there will be a recovery one day. Folks, no matter how bad it seems, and if you're out of a job, and if it just looks like it's never, never, never going to get better, we know eventually it will. The dollar's not going to zero, which reminds me, I have to tell you something about what's going on with Peter Schiff and Crash Proof and all that. We had him on a few weeks ago, and we had Mish Shedlock on, I think, last week, and we talked about that, but I want to tell you about something, so hold on to that. But basically, it's going to get better. Eventually, it's going to get better, right? It has to. But basically, what we did was we put together a report called Technology for an Obama Recovery. It's about an 8 or 9 page report that we put out every so often. You can go grab that at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We left it right at the top of the page so you can get it. Just You just got to put a couple pieces of information there, and you can grab that report. I think you'll enjoy that. It gives a good outline. We're also going to put the same thing on MSN Strategy Lab. By the way, we're still in first place, up 14.25% as of right now. And it looks like they're coming down the home stretch, and there's a good chance that I'm going to be crowned king of the MSN Strategy Lab, whatever that means. I don't think it means much, but I'm pretty proud of it. It was a lot of work for 8 months, putting in the time and effort to expose exactly how we do what we do here and to show it to the world. It was pretty nerve-wracking as well, because I had one rule going into it. One rule. You know what that was? Do not blow up. I told everybody in my office, do not blow up. No matter what happens, no matter how the markets treat us, do not blow up. And that's kind of the rule that we go by with our portfolios as well, I guess, and how we handle everyday life and everyday markets. But I want to get back to that story I was mentioning a second ago, and then we're going to get into a conversation. Kind of an interesting change up today. We're going to be talking about angel investing, and then we're going to also talk with Kevin Hoffman, my lead portfolio analyst, about Contango, if you haven't heard about that. We've switched over and actually did a great job of I was real proud of this work that he did on figuring out exactly the right time to get into and out of, but back into oil. And we hit it quite well, and we're up about 25% on one of our investments in UCO, which is a double leveraged oil, fully correlated to the oil, not the inverse, but the fully correlated. And that's doing very well, which, by the way, we also went short the, I think I told you this last week, TBT, which is the long treasury. It seemed that there was a bubble forming there, and that's worked out about 22% higher on that. But nonetheless, these are things that you can find out that we do. We also have a trial going on. If you want to do a kind of a, what are we calling it? Not really a trial, but a kind of a test, a road test, and take us for a test drive of the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy. All you have to do is write Laura and tell her or write trials@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we'll give you a 10-day free trial to see the private blog, exactly what we're talking about, how we're doing what we're doing, give you an inside peek into exactly what's going on. So I suggest you take advantage of that. But basically, we're going to talk about Contango and how that's working. Lots happening. So we're going to talk about angel investing. We're going to talk about Contango today. We're going to talk about, remind you, the money show in Orlando, February 5th and 6th and 7th or so. If you want to meet me, I want to meet you. We're having a cocktail party, folks. I'm giving away free books. If you want to come, all you have to do is tell us that you want to meet us there. And write to me or write to Laura. Just come to the site. There's going to be something on there if you want to join us. And please don't be shy. It's in Orlando. We're going to have a good time the Thursday night. And without further ado, let's get into this discussion. I want to talk to this gent over here. He wrote a book. He wrote a book that is about the area of angel investing. I don't know if you've heard about that before. I didn't know a lot about that. You know, I know about VC and venture capital, but it's really kind of pre-VC. And it's really well in advance of the whole idea of that. His name is Dr. Scott Shane. And let's get into a conversation with him, because I want to find out if there's actually anything going on in this area at all. It would seem like it's pretty dead, because there's no money available for lending. And people that have money are kind of, holding it pretty tight to the vest right now. But who knows? Maybe there's an opportunity for us to make some money. So let's get into a discussion with the professor, Dr. Scott Shane. And he's actually up north. He's a professor at Case Western and an author of the new book that is out now that is all about angel investing and something that's called The Truth Behind Angel Investing. And I think that it's something that's going to be enjoyable. How is the weather up there, my friend? A little cold, huh?
Yeah, it is, with a lot of snow on the ground as well.
Oh, really? I feel really bad for you. I mean, of course, I say this as I'm talking to you from beautiful, sunny Florida. Did I insult you?
No, you have a big advantage, though, being down there.
Anyway, everybody eventually comes down here. That's a blessing and a curse. They say, what's the difference? So what if fish and guests have in common? They have the 3 days, they both stink.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, so you wrote this book called Fool's Gold, The Truth Behind Angel Investing in America. And I had an opportunity to go through this, but I really like to talk to you about, let's talk about, I think many people have heard of VC, venture capital, and this is kind of before that. This is talk about the ground floor, right? The angel investing is the beginnings of it all. So why don't you tell me a little bit about, what really makes that up, and what have you found out?
Well, the big thing that's really important about angel investing is that these are people who are investing their own money in these companies, which makes it a little different than venture capitalists, who do tend to come later. But the venture capitalists, it's somebody else's money that they're investing. And, angels are taking their own money and putting it into somebody else's business in the hopes of making a return, or in some cases doing it even if they don't make a return because they just want to get involved in working with the startups.
So, like you said, this is people using their own money. So this the other day we saw, for example, the president, CEO of Bank of America putting in their own money into their shares in the hopes that they were going to kind of put the word out there that, hey, if I believe in it, then it's good. Is that kind of what we're dealing with? Is the point is if somebody's putting their own hard-earned money into something, we have a belief that maybe that they're not just going to be wasteful and there's something to this?
Well, I think people think differently about investing their own money in a couple of ways. One is, you know, if it's my money, I'm going to think about it differently than if it's somebody else's money. In part, I can take more risks because it's up to me and I don't have a fiduciary responsibility to someone else. Mm-hmm. Also, I might think about it differently because it's my money and that might have an effect on how I think about it. Maybe I'm conservative. Maybe I like to take risks. The other thing is that angels aren't doing this for their job, which means they're generally doing it on the side. And that has a lot of effects on their willingness to do due diligence or how much due diligence they can do given the time, how many investments they can make, because this is a lot to manage if you're also working at a job at the same time.
Right, kind of a part-time thing. So let's back it up a second and let's kind of get the definition of, or let's talk about maybe what the myth is. What is this, you know, what do people generally think? When what did you find out that people generally thought about what an angel investor is and what's it all about?
Well, because the media talks mostly about a small number of cases of really successful angel investment, most people think that angels are investing in high-tech companies that tend to be very successful. They tend to go public. The amounts tend to be on the larger side, and the returns are phenomenally large. And you get that impression because if people keep telling the story about, you know, the angel investment in Google or the angel investment in the body shop and the amounts of money that those angels made, you get the impression that this happens more often than it actually does. And the reality is that angels tend to make investments in more local companies around where they are. They're less technology focused. They invest smaller amounts of money and the returns are lower than the myths that we have.
Yeah. And the myth, the theory is, you know, you think, first of all, you're thinking angel and you're thinking this, I don't know, when I think of it, you know, this whole, wow, I'd love to get in on the total ground floor. The opportunities are endless. I'm going to get this at such a low price. But the truth of the matter is when you start getting into the next stage, if an angel investment of some sort gets to the next stage and you get into VC, which I suppose is the next stage of this, right? Or potentially the next stage of it. They need money from somewhere to get this thing expanding, right? Is that true?
Right. So, right. Although what's really important to realize is that only a really small percentage of the businesses that get angel investment get that subsequent venture financing. So yes, in what people like to do is they'd like to have, you know, an investment from the angel that gets followed by the venture capitalist and the company grows and it exits, but oftentimes it's the angel invests and no one else invests after that and the company goes under.
Right. I would think that you're not going to hear those stories as much as you hear all the great from rags to riches stories, but there's a lot of from rags to rags stories, I suppose, right?
Or from riches to rags stories.
Right. Exactly. So now you have the next stage, though, that could be VC. And the reason why I touch upon this is, again, it has this sort of je ne sais quoi, this feeling that, you know, you got the cocktail parties and you got the trips and the limos. And I don't know, when I think of the whole VC world, there's a lot of money flowing around. But the truth of the matter is that once a company, if it's my company, we go to the next round and we go to VC. I mean, when I'm looking for investors at that level, particularly when it's angel, there's a lot of strings attached, isn't there?
Yeah, there are. And, you know, part of this is that, you know, investors are going to be very careful because they've got to, first of all, weed through a lot of opportunities to find the good ones. And it's actually pretty hard to do that because unlike, say, buying stocks in a public company where you have actually a lot of information about the past performance of the company and what's going on, usually when you're talking about evaluating these businesses, there's no track record. And so you're evaluating things that the entrepreneur has essentially created as a fiction because they write up their business plan based on what they'd like to happen. And of course, all of those tell great stories and everything is always going up. And then you have to kind of figure out, well, which ones are really going to do this and which aren't when it's going to be a small number that are and most of them aren't.
I always found the idea of a business plan is necessary, But it's pretty ridiculous because when it's presented, you're just like you said. I mean, the fact is that you don't, I don't think you know exactly what can be assessed as truth or not. It's all this vision, and so much of it doesn't come true. And when you get into a firm that's small and you have either a new product, a new service, a new idea, I mean, so much of that is going to happen as it happens that it's very difficult. I think, you know, in angel investing, we're really talking about taking the ultimate fly on the money. It's is there any difference between that and gambling?
Well, I think that generally people have a belief somehow that they can figure some of this out. And it may be no different than gambling in the sense that some people figure out that they know how to count cards and they do that. But, you know, I want to point out just a couple of statistics on this that really illustrate the point about trying to figure this out. So I actually looked at the census data and I report this in the book, which talks about how many businesses hit this $50 million in sales level in 6 years, the kind of numbers that people talk about that angels are looking for. And if you look across, you know, technology-intensive industries, it's less than 2% of businesses. Now, actually, for the angel group that I'm part of, the North Coast Angel Fund here in Ohio, I actually looked at the business plans that were sent to the group and the projections and how many of those businesses projected having sales of over $50 million in 5 years. And basically, it's over 90% projected that. So now you realize that less than 2% of businesses are going to do this. When you're looking at the plans, you're looking at well over 90% making those projections. Most of those projections have got to be wrong. And the thing is, right, it's hard to believe a lot about projections when you realize that so many of them can't be true.
Right. I mean, it's all about the personal projection. So think about this. This is something I think is interesting. When you know, and this goes into the idea of behavioral finance a bit and into the markets, frankly. You know, if I was to ask the question, anybody listening right now, if I was to ask this question, are you an above-average driver? I think most people would say, yeah, I'm an above-average driver. But think about that for a second. If everybody is an above-average driver, how could that possibly be? I mean, where's the average, right? And if people are taking these visions and they envision what they can do as above average or as, you know, doing a lot more because they are who they are, that's great. I think that's awesome. I mean, listen, let's have all the confidence in the world. Let's get things done. You know, we're in this whole mode of change right now and all great. But at the same time, as an outside investor looking in, I think that's really what we're talking about here. When somebody's asking you for money at the ground level, maybe there's some more investigation and maybe we need to temper the projections a bit and understand that many of those may be warped by, you know, someone's own sense of potential for success. Is that a good translation?
There is. And I can give you, for instance, of how this really requires a lot of discipline on the part of an angel. So you know, the numbers show that about 5 or 6% of the investments made by people in these angel groups have an IPO or a or get acquired by somebody and make money. And then the rest of them either, you know, limp along for a little while and die, or they die quickly and really don't provide much in the way of returns. So to make money in angel investing, right, you make it all on 5 or 6% of the investments. And to do that and have a decent return, those 5 or 6 have to be phenomenally successful, right? You need to get, you know, 30, 35 times your money in a short period of time. Now, here's the problem that happens is angels get a bunch of business plans presented to them, and they look at one and they go, wow, that's kind of an interesting business. And they look at the projections, and it's not going to give them, you know, 30, 35 times their money. It's going to give them 20 times. And they say, well, you know, 20 times isn't a bad number, so I'm going to bend my rules and I'm going to invest in that one. And they do that several times, right? And now they get this portfolio, and instead of having a bunch of businesses with expectation of 30 to 35 times their money, they've got them with 20 times their money. And they've convinced themselves that 20 is a big number and that's okay. But because such a small percentage are successful, they get that small percentage, and on that they get their 20 times the money, and then they look at the overall portfolio and it's not that good. And it's not good because they weren't disciplined. They didn't say, I have this rule and I'm going to stick to it. And the reason it's so hard to stick to that rule is so few businesses can really project these kinds of numbers and actually do it, that when you get done with the due diligence, you're saying no to almost everybody. And nobody really likes to do that. And they like to try to accommodate people somehow so they don't feel bad about saying no all the time. And that's a very difficult thing to do, is to resist that.
So you are in an angel group. So this is a group of people that are obviously reviewing various business proposals and projections. And I would venture to say that much of the work that you do is hypothetical, and it has to be envisioned, because there really is no substantial, many of the time, substantial or tangible business. What is a typical meeting? What do you do at a typical angel investor meeting, and how many people are there? And, you know, and then I want to kind of go into maybe some of your experience of really, you know, the real life experience of how much money you've made and things like that. Well, maybe not exactly, but so let's start with that. So at a typical meeting, a typical angel group, what is that all about?
Well, I should point out that the group that I'm in is actually organized a little bit unusually, because it's set up as a fund. And the way that it works is there are 99 members that have each put in $25,000 into the fund. And the fund also is leveraged with some money from the state of Ohio for making these investments. But because of that, we have, and because we're fairly large, we have a professional staff member whose job it is to kind of do initial screening. And then we have a committee that does another level of screening in that committee. You know, people vary who are on that committee. And then people come and present. Usually we have monthly meetings. Usually it's about two companies presenting, seeking funding. They make a presentation. And then we vote to decide whether or not we want to go to do due diligence. And if we vote yes and on a company we want to do due diligence, we also have to have three members that agree to do it. Sometimes we vote that collectively we want to do due diligence, but nobody wants to actually do it, and then we can't go forward with the investment. But then those three people are part of this group, and they conduct due diligence, they investigate that opportunity, they come back and they report on it, and then the group votes on whether or not they want to make the investment on the terms that are proposed by the committee that did the due diligence. Mm-hmm. In addition, people have the opportunity then, they could make a sidecar investment. They could say, okay, in addition to what the fund is making, I want to put some other money in, but I'm going to do it on the terms that the group has agreed to.
Right, so you don't step in front of somebody else.
Exactly.
Nobody gets a better deal than the average. I mean, that was kind of like what people got upset about, and please nobody throw any tomatoes right now, but that's kind of what Buffett did. Buffett kind of got a better deal than the average investor got when he bought, let's say, Goldman. And, you know, the question has been knocked around, is that fair? So what you're trying to do is knock out that potential, or at least that's what's going on, so that people don't, you know, get a great idea and then somehow invest in it ahead of the rest of the group, which I think that's a fair way to do things.
Right. I think it is as well.
Yeah. So, okay. So now your experience, and by the way, you set this up as a hedge fund. Hedge funds usually have a 99 max and a certain requirements. I find it interesting, actually, the state of Ohio put money in there, especially with all these states. Well, this is probably before there was problems in the municipalities, but I wonder if they're going to – they're not knocking on your door to get it back yet, are they?
No, and in fact, part of this is that it's part of a whole initiative that was put in and set up a couple of years ago. And so essentially the funds that, you know, they've been committed, and they can't really take them back at this point. But a lot of states are doing similar things, because the problem is, if the state wants to encourage these kinds of investments, the problem is they can't do it themselves, right? There's all kinds of conflicts and issues there. So what they try to do is invest in organizations that do it, so that you don't have somebody sitting in the state government trying to make investments in companies, which
this is interesting. You know, this is actually kind of interesting if you really think about this. Let's go back to Buffett for a second. I've always said that Warren Buffett has been more of a business owner than an investor. That's not a good or bad issue. That's just, I think, what happens. You know, he's buying quality businesses, and that he believes is at least quality, and he's investing, and that's where he's made his fortune. So what's interesting here is there's a bit of a parallel, it seems to me. But what the difference here is that you could actually be working with people, or the plans right now with the states, if you're an angel investment group, and you're buying businesses and you're setting up these businesses, but at the same time you're helping, I mean, I'm not to sound too corny here, but you're helping the economy in a way, because you're funneling monies through, and at the same time creating a great investment opportunity, hopefully, if you do this right, of course, for not only the state, but for the people investing. So that it's whereas the individual person may never put their money in their pocket to give to John Jones down over there at the ice cream shop, or whatever the exact investment is, whatever the exact company is, because he wasn't able to really control it, didn't have the time and abilities. Well, now you have the money inside of an angel fund. You get some funding by the state. Everybody kind of gets it's a win-win for everybody potentially. Is that right?
Right, and I think that's the idea. And in fact, in part of the research that I did for the book, actually, it was research I did before the book, but really motivated me to do it. I did a bunch of focus groups with angels all over the country on behalf of several of the Federal Reserve banks that wanted to figure some of this out. And one of the things that comes up very clearly is that a significant minority of angels aren't really interested in this to make money. That they actually view their angel investments as extremely unlikely to make them any money. And if they're going to try to make money, they're going to do it other ways. But they do this because they want to help the economic development of their area and because they find it enjoyable as a hobby. And, you know, people describe things and, you know, explain this in ways that say, you know, look, this is actually a whole lot more interesting than trying to put a ball in a hole 300 yards away. And I spend an awful lot of money on, you know, that hobby. So I could spend a little money on this hobby as well. And if you've got a bunch of angels whose goal is really, they're not going to complain if they make money, but that's not the purpose. The purpose is because they like it and because they want to help out, then partnering with the state is a good idea because that's essentially the state's motive too, the economic development part of it. And so that works well. And if you can bring in the other angels who are interested to make money, well, you know, that works too.
Interesting. So in the end of your experience, how long has this Angel Fund been in existence that you have?
So this fund, we're in our third year. So we actually, this particular Angel Fund, we do not yet have any exits. And, you know, a lot of the members of, and this is true for many Angel Funds or Angel groups in the country, most of them are quite young. People think that the first one is only dates from the early 90s, and that's the Band of Angels in California. And their big growth was basically since 2000 that we've seen these grow. So a lot of them don't have exits, but the people who are in the groups often made angel investments other ways before they joined the groups. And some of them have found that there's a lot of advantages to being part of a group. It's really quite efficient for, you know, things like doing due diligence and managing deal flow and things like that. But most of the groups don't have a lot of exits to report yet.
Mm-hmm. So as the title, Fool's Gold, The Truth Behind Angel Investing in America, I mean, the connotation there is that, you know what, it sounds a lot better than it is, and what most people think it is, it's really not. And what I would take away from this conversation is that if you don't do it with a business mind and thinking that it's just an easy process to get rich quick, you're making a very serious mistake.
Right. And actually the title Fool's Gold is a pun, right? Because when people talk about who the informal investors in startups are, the expression is friends, family, and fools. And so one connotation of fool's gold is it's the gold that fools make or the gold that angels make, and it's the money that the angels make. The other connotation of the title is that it's fool's gold. It isn't real, right? It's something that people think is valuable, but it turns out not to be. And so the idea is to kind of get, well, when is it real and when is it not? And why is it that the typical angel doesn't do very well at all, and that's nothing to aspire to, but there are lessons to be learned from how a small number of angels do this and what makes them successful.
Yeah, because a lot of things you need to know, like there's tax credits available from certain states, different taxing policies, of course. You know, there's different ways of valuing an angel investment versus a regular investment. I mean, it's a whole different thing going on here than your average investment, I should say.
But to give you a sense of how skewed this is, that there a survey of the people who are members of these angel groups, and to be a member of a group, you have to be an accredited investor. Mm-hmm. And not all angels are accredited investors, and members of angel groups tend to actually be more sophisticated about entrepreneurship than the average angel. We have some evidence of that. So when I'm describing the performance of angel group investors, I'm talking about better than the average angel investor.
Mm-hmm.
The typical angel group investor, actually 40% of those people have never made any money on any of their angel investments. Okay. Mm-hmm. So only 60% have made money, and 7% of those angel investors have made 3/4 of the money made in angel investing by angel groups or by members of angel.
So the 80-20 rule.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. And what's important about that is that now you realize that the typical angel group member and by extension the typical angel isn't successful and they're no model. And what you really need to do is say, okay, look, that small number who's really successful, what do they do differently? Because obviously they must have a different approach than everybody else, or they're just really, really lucky.
Yeah,
it's one of those two things.
Exactly. So sometimes it's good to be lucky, but I agree that you got to be careful, especially when it comes to this ground effort. Well, that's great. I mean, so I don't know if there's any parting points that you would want to cover. A few things here, a lot of things, but any parting thoughts? I mean, if somebody want to either get involved or maybe telling people really what they need to be aware of. And obviously, we're talking much more than just a simple, hey, Bob, can I borrow a grand to start up a business? We're talking a different level here, a little bit more organized, hopefully. But, you know, in closing, I mean, what is it that you could leave us to understand more about it and then find out where we can get more information?
Well, I think the key thing is to realize angel investing, there's information out there about how you can do it well, and that's different than how the typical person does it. And if you're thinking about doing it seriously, ask yourself a question, am I doing this because I think it's going to be fun and because I want to help out the community, in which case, really don't worry about it and go ahead and do it. If you think you're doing it because you want to make money, then I would urge people to try to figure out stuff and look at least the idea and the piece of information in my book or elsewhere, which tells what the successful angels do that's different than the rest.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I got to put some of the, if you don't mind, I'm going to put some of the topics that you had sent me up on the site. There's some interesting things about, you know, who are the actual, the people that are angel investors and who aren't, what are the sources of financing, capital and all that. So that's great. And I'll put up a link to the book and to your website. And I do appreciate you, Dr. Scott Shane, writing the book, Fool's Gold, The Truth Behind Angel Investing in America, for joining us on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. So, you know, I promised in the beginning of the show that we're going to have a conversation with Kevin Hoffman, my lead portfolio analyst and portfolio manager here. And I wanted to talk about this discussion of contango. It's not a dance, so don't worry about that. But it's this discussion about oil and some of the things that are going on right now in the oil and maybe what that means kind of to us. So, Kevin, give us a kind of a rundown. What's the story with this contango?
Well, there's something interesting happening in the oil markets right now. Oil markets have seen an increase in the number of reserves since oil has gone from just over $140 per barrel down to around $36 to, you know, $44 per barrel in a matter of months. The inventories on oil reserves, as reported on last Wednesday, excluding those in the government's strategic petroleum reserves, rose to 332 million barrels.
You know, Kevin, let me just interrupt you. Let me ask you something.
Sure.
So we had oil increase in value like ridiculously. You know, I mean, in terms of the amount of barrels that were in the reserves. In other words, oil was not being utilized, right? And we saw this incredible drop in oil prices for about, I don't know, 30 minutes or so. And then they sort of came right back up. Is this all related to this contango issue?
Yeah, much of the supply increase is due to this contango. And basically what contango is that it's when the futures price is above the expected spot price or cash price for oil. So the oil futures contracts, as priced, as quoted on the New York Mercantile Exchange, have higher prices for July 2009 delivery than the current price. So this may create an opportunity for those who have the ability to store oil relatively cheap. So when we see the supply increases go up to 332 million barrels, it's because a lot of these investment banks and other companies are storing oil so that they can profit off of it later on, and looking to sell it maybe in December for a much higher price than these low prices we've seen so far.
So what happens is now, because there is such a disparity between the price now and the future, is where we get this contango. And then usually what happens is there isn't this disparity. In fact, it's quite opposite. I think that's called reverse back intermediation.
It's a normal backwardization.
Norman, upside down, reversal, normal backwardization, which means, what do you know, how do you explain that?
Well, normal backwardization is, you know, the exact opposite of contango. So that's when you have the prices of the futures contracts, so say like a July 2009 delivery, would be much cheaper than what the cash price or current price of oil is.
Now, why would we have that, though? I mean, what circumstances? It would always seem that in an option or in any kind of situation where we have, you know, we're looking into the future for something. So, for example, there's a time value where something can go up or down. So why would we normally have it that the futures are lower in price? Are we assuming that the commodity is a wasting asset?
Yeah, it's possible that, you know, the supply concerns for later on are going to be much lower. You also have some seasonal factors that are in there as well. So it's just something that it's not normal that you see it that way. It's normally the contango that you see due to the fact that you have that you know, that time value as well as you know, the cost of holding the actual commodity.
Yeah, so that's a big issue. So now they have to hold. So we have all these tankers floating around the various seas of the earth, filled with oil, that are renting it out just to kind of, I guess there's parties going on, people are just hanging out, babysitting oil, it seems to me. That's what I envision, at least, right?
That's so, right.
So now, because the spread is so great, and this great makes a great opportunity, essentially, and just to make this an easy example, we have a company that is buying a ship, and you have to be a big company in order to buy the full amount of the vessel, you know, because it's expensive, there's a lot of oil that goes in there, but let's say it's $35 per barrel, as an example. And the forward contract in 3 months from now is sold for $45. So you got to also assume that you're going to pay an amount of money that's equal to some kind of monthly fee for the rental of the vessel. And that being the case, you still can potentially almost lock in a profit of, let's say, I don't know, $7 per barrel. I mean, that's interesting, right?
Yeah, I mean, it creates an arbitrage opportunity for these investment banks that you know, have the power and have the ability to lease those super tankers that you talk about and hold on to them.
So what happens after all these super tankers are filled up? Does that mean that rates are going up? I mean, we talked a few weeks ago with you. It's interesting. We talked about the same topics. We talked about big ships. I don't know what that's about. We talked about the Baltic Dry Index, right? Is there any relationship here? I mean, in terms of, or not relationship, is there any similarity, I should say, in terms of the fact that is it going to be shipping prices are going to go up because of this, or is there going to be all of a sudden this flood of oil in the market soon?
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole reason behind people, you know, putting this oil on super tankers, is because, you know, the Baltic Dry Index is, you know, so cheap right now, so all these tankers are just kind of sitting in bay or in the, you know, in the harbor, and you know, people are looking to make money still on those things. So it gives them an opportunity to hold those barrels of oil on those ships for a very cheap price.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I wonder what's going to happen, because I do fear that we're going to have two things that are going to happen. It leads to the opportunity for them artificially trying to in a way push up prices, but not too much, because of the fact that they want to make sure that they get their futures prices and keep the contango spreads pretty distant, you know, pretty wide. So that on one hand, that keeps the prices down. On the other hand, you have to wonder, you know, what are they going to do to – this is kind of like messing with Mother Nature, because now what they're doing is they're storing these things for the future. I just wonder what kind of effect it's going to have in the long term. And, in fact, if there is this glut of oil, how long has it been that way?
Right.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. Right now, you know, let's get back to that Baltic Dry Index. You know, we talked about the fact that at the height of it, it was somewhere about 11,500.
Yeah.
And now it's about 800 and change. Now, what's interesting about that is that we've seen a tick up off the bottom. I mean, I don't know how much further it could have gone down, but we reached a low about 3 weeks ago. But what's interesting is we're seeing a turnaround now in the index itself, which indicates that there may be some opportunity, and that's why we're seeing some of the shippers really starting to break out a little bit here. Some of them have come down a little bit, but it's kind of interesting, I think, that. And these two things are very interrelated, because what I see these as, if we can look at the shipping rates on the oil side and this contango, and also more so the Baltic Dry, it's a very interesting leading indicator for the economies, the world economies.
Definitely is. I mean, there's a lot of volatility within those shipping companies just because there's a lot of speculation going on as to, you know, when they're going to start, you know, start shipping goods again because everything's been so depressed as of late. But, you know, as soon as those shipping companies start to take hold, then you're going to see a rather large jump within, you know, like Excel Maritime or Dry Ships and other shipping companies that are out there.
Yeah, I appreciate it. All right, we're going to put some information about contango. You know, we wrote that piece also, just that definition about contango, put those charts up on the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. I mentioned to everybody tonight, but I think for the first time today, that we have that test drive on the blog site, the private blog site. So this actually, Kevin and I put together a definition of contango, some pictures. So if you do want to take that trial over at TDI Managed Growth, just write trials at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And mail it to us, and we'll be happy to set you up with a 10-day free trial of that. So, Kevin, thanks so much. See you tomorrow.
All right, thank you.
And we're going to end on that note. That was pretty cool talking about that. My understanding is that a lot of companies are starting to do a lot of buying of these tankers. A lot of companies are looking into really picking up these tankers and the tanking companies. We're going to do some searching to find if we find anybody that makes any sense to do so, because if oil is going to pop back, they're going to want to supply as much as they can, and they think there's going to be a big turnaround in oil. And we actually believe that we're at the bottoming stages of oil as well, and there's some great opportunities right now. But we're not just going to go buy a tanker, I'll tell you that. We'll find an alternative investment to do so. So thanks a lot for listening today to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And like I said, if you haven't done so, go check out twit.tv. That's over at Lee Laporte's site. And I was on it last week. I thought it was kind of a fun show. I think you'll enjoy it. Pick it up on iTunes itself, and make sure that if you have any questions or anything, you know where to find me. I hope to see you in Orlando for the Money Show, and of course, we're going to have some great recordings and a live simulcast of the Strategy Lab, where I'll be on a panel and teaching a class, as a matter of fact. So if you want to know about some really neat and powerful portfolio techniques, disciplined investor style, well, just come on over. We'll be happy to get together, and of course, we're having that cocktail party. So just write in, and then we'll see you. I appreciate your time. We'll see you soon. This is Andrew Horowitz, the Disciplined Investor Podcast. See you next week. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor Horowitz is a certified financial planner.